Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I'm here in the studio today with Stephen Thompson, who's a writer for NPR Music. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
Well, Stephen and I are here every week for regular Pop Culture Happy Hour shows, but today we are introducing something that's kind of special for us.
It is a super special, very special episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
It absolutely is. Today we are getting to bring you a conversation that Barry Hardiman, a friend of our show and sometime panelist on our show, had with the novelist behind the Robert Galbraith mystery novels.
I've heard of Robert Galbraith, but I feel like the actual author's name is a little more familiar.
That's right. I feel like we know this author by another name, and that name is J.K. Rowling, who you might know from some books about wizards and so forth. Mm-hmm. But in this conversation, she and Barry talk about the book Career of Evil, which is the new Galbraith book. And, you know, for those of you who are reading it, we always try to keep things not too spoilery, right. But they do talk a little bit about some of the plot points in the book. But it's a great conversation. They had a lot of fun. We're really excited for you to hear it. If you like this kind of conversation, there are other Pop Culture Happy Hour segments that we've done that are about books and reading that you might be into no matter what you like. We had conversations this year about novels from Judy Blume and Nick Hornby.
Mm-hmm. The Ms. Marvel comic. There was a discussion of David Foster Wallace.
And an entire episode all about romance novels.
That's right.
So if you're interested in those kinds of things and you're interested in the stuff we've done about books, we're going to provide links to all of those episodes at npr.org/popculturehappyhour. And that's also where you can subscribe to our podcast and get more great conversations every week. So we're going to take a break for just a minute. And when we come back, we're going to have Barry Hardiman talking with J.K. Rowling.
This very special episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour featuring J.K. Rowling is sponsored by Squarespace, who brings you this message. Squarespace is the simplest way to create a magical website for your business, portfolio, blog, or wedding. Start your free trial today and see why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace at squarespace.com/popculture.
Hello and welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Barry Hardiman. This is technically called a small batch, but that's not quite the right modifier as this is a very, very big batch. My guest today is mystery writer Robert Galbraith. He wrote a well-reviewed debut mystery novel, which got even more attention after an anonymous tip outed the author as J.K. Rowling, who is famous for her earlier work about a wizard. Today, she's here to talk with me about the third book in the Robert Galbraith mystery series. It's called Career of Evil, and it brings back private detective Cormoran Strike and his secretary/partner, Robin Ellicott. Strike and Robin are now kind of famous after their successes in previous cases, and they're back to solve a pretty horrifying crime. Someone has just sent Robin a severed leg. On that note, let me now introduce J.K. Rowling, a.k.a. Robert Galbraith. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Thank you very much indeed. Delighted to be here.
I'm going to start with the last page of this book, but don't worry, it's not actually a spoiler. I'm going to start with the acknowledgments.
Because you
wrote that Robert Galbraith felt like your own personal playground. First of all, that's a playground with a high body count.
We shouldn't take that too literally.
I don't really like to frolic
in meadows with dismembered body.
I thought probably not, but I did want to ask you what that meant to you.
I think because of the way that I started writing the books, obviously using a pseudonym, it felt like a very private pleasure. You know, there was no expectation. No one knew I was writing The Cuckoo's Calling, which was the first in the series. Mm-hmm. I felt a sense of liberation, I suppose. And I wasn't sure when I was outed unwillingly as the author whether that would continue. But in fact, quite miraculously, it has. There's something about writing under a pseudonym. I just feel I'm in a different space when I'm there. I also agreed with my publisher, even once I was outed, that I wouldn't do the same kind of level of marketing that I would do for a book under my own name. So that's been useful in keeping the focus on the work. And yeah, it's just been a really pleasurable experience for me.
Before you actually started writing in this genre, who were you reading?
Like everyone who likes crime fiction, I love your golden age writers. So obviously I had read when I was very young. I loved Christie when I was younger.
Yeah.
I loved Niall Marsh. I liked Marjorie Allingham. I liked Dorothy L. Sayers.
I love Dorothy Sayers.
Yeah, all of those books. So those were things that I read when I was a lot younger, and they formed, I suppose, the basis for a passion for crime. My Scottish colleague and now good friend Val McDermott, coming right up to date, I think is an absolute master of the genre. I've read Patricia Cornwell, a lot of women, actually, but not only women. Belinda Bauer, who I met for the first time just the other day, is fabulous. So my taste is pretty Catholic, and I love seeing what other people are doing. And it was a genre that I'd read for pleasure for a long time, and I'd also wanted to write for a long time.
So when you did sit down to write it, when you created Cormoran Strike, who is both totally unique, but also or entirely himself, and is also, you know, really an archetype as well. You know, he's your sort of detective who is both emotionally and truly physically scarred. How did he come to you?
I had the idea for Cormoran in a slightly mysterious way that most of my favorite characters have come to me, in that he, it sounds terribly corny, but it is the truth, so I shall say it. Some of them just walk out of your subconscious and stand in front of you.
Oh.
And he just did that, or he limped out of my subconscious. If I want to analyze why he was in my subconscious, I could say that I know several veterans. One of my very closest friends is a veteran. I am interested, as I think a lot of people are, in what happens to people who leave the forces and have to make their way in civilian life. That seemed, you know, a real issue for our times. He just came to me, and then it was, as I often, again, it may sound rather strange or peculiar, once he'd walked in front of me, it was a question of finding out what he was all about. And with the characters that I like best, it often does feel as though I'm discovering what's already there rather than inventing. And I felt that very strongly with both him and Robin, who is his sidekick, his female sidekick, I should clarify.
Right, right. I wonder, since you had such a strong premonition of Cormoran and Robin, did the mysteries then, did they come second?
Well, do you know, funnily enough, the plots for the first three novels, I cannot now remember, I genuinely can't remember which one came first, because I had them all. And then I sort of line them up like marbles to see which arrangement pleased me best. Because of the greater story arc I had for Cormoran and for Robin, I decided that I wanted his first case to be the case dealing with the famous person, because I wanted to have him undergo a journey in the first novel between total obscurity into some form of prominence, which would then set him up for the second book, where there would be a good reason for someone to come and ferret him out as someone who was clearly good at his job. So each plot serves the next. So I had an idea of his larger story, and then I was really fitting my plots to service that larger story.
There's a real scaffolding in this book that I think is so well told. You don't really, as a reader, you're just on the journey.
Thank you so much for saying that, because I will interrupt you only
for
a good reason, I hope. I planned this book to a degree that I have never planned a novel before.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. So that it's not, it didn't just come fully formed from. I'm so glad to know there was a degree of real.
Oh
yeah.
My God, no.
Because it's
no,
so
no,
complex.
No, no.
It really
is,
yeah.
An incredibly complex plot. But the work goes into not burdening the reader with how complex it is. The reader should be able to just, as you say, enjoy the ride. It's my job to make sure the underpinnings are there. So you're on the roller coaster, but nothing is creaking underneath you. So I planned and planned and planned this novel. I knew it was going to be technically very, very challenging. And I relished that. I wanted to push myself. I worked exceptionally hard on the scaffolding, as you say.
The book is unusual in that it presents these three suspects at the beginning.
Right.
And that you write a lot of chapters in the voice of the murderer. So the reader then has this experience of left wondering which suspect matches up with that voice. And part of the enjoyment is moving your money from suspect to suspect. You know, I spent the first half of the book thinking it was one of them and then another. And when it does come to plotting, how do you work out the different sort of digressions that you were going to take the reader on without breaking their trust?
I felt that there are a lot of things going on in this novel, more than may appear as you dive in. And for me, it was very important to maintain the reader's interest without feeling that they were being led down pointless rabbit holes for my own amusement.
Mm-hmm.
The number one rule in this genre is you have to play fair.
Yes.
So, you know, as many red herrings as you want, as long as they're well written and plausible, the reader will forgive you. What they won't forgive you is not setting out all the information in front of them, because then you are cheating. I had an eye to that, as I think every competent detective writer should have.
So we talked a little bit about the body count here.
Mm-hmm.
In the first two books, there are murders. This is evil on another level.
Yeah, it is.
There is a murderer who is literally dismembering women. There is a pedophile. There's a serial abuser.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to inhabit a world that contained really close quarters? You are inside the head with the worst that the world can offer.
It was horrible, actually. This is the first book that's ever given me nightmares, literal nightmares. What gave me nightmares was the research, because I felt that I needed to do a lot of research to understand a certain mindset, which is clearly very, very far removed from my own. I read an awful lot of case studies. It was that that gave me nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those suspects is loosely based, not entirely based, but has features of a real killer or criminal. So I was trying to make sure that each of those suspects was psychologically very consistent, and they had have histories, varying degrees, like real men. But it was very, very, very important to me that this didn't become what I call violence porn.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very important to me that the damage inflicted is felt to be real and human, and Robin, who is one of our central characters, is key to revealing what it feels like to come up against someone like this and what that does to their life. These are not pieces of meat. Mm-hmm. These are not mannequins to be dismembered. And it was important to me that those scenes were not written with a view to titillation, but to understand why it is so essential that this man is caught.
We discover in this book that Robin has been through an assault herself.
Exactly.
And it's tough to read if you've read the other ones, particularly because Robin is so spunky and plucky, and it's hard to imagine. And then you do have to put, more than even the other victims in this book, you do have to put a face on.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is one of the reasons why I say I juggled these three plots, which was going to come, in what order was I going to write them? I wanted the reader to know or to think they knew Robin before finding out what had happened to her in the past.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was very important, because I wanted the reader to feel the weight of that,
mm-hmm.
that they knew the human being. They didn't first of all see the survivor.
Yes.
And that is something that can very easily be lost in life and in literature when you're talking about this kind of mindset and this kind of violence. Giving the survivor a voice, a face, giving them their due humanity is really important to me.
I was grateful for that because, you know, I think often in literature, particularly the rape of a woman is seen as a signifier rather than...
Exactly.
And because this was, you had the foresight to wait,
yeah.
It gave us a chance
this is
to
not,
feel it.
Exactly. And as Robin says in the book, this does not define her.
Mm-hmm.
She is many, 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 many things. And that's about giving her her weight as a human and not seeing her merely as the vehicle for some grotesque act that someone else decided to perpetuate. So I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. I also wanted to examine in the book her attitude to the crimes as a survivor and as a woman, and Strike's attitude to the crimes. He cannot see these aberrations in the same way that Robin sees them, because he will never, ever understand it from her side of the fence, as it were. So that was an interesting dynamic and an interesting male-female change of perspective that I enjoyed writing.
The glimpses of the murderer that we get are terrifying. Women are objects. They are things.
Mm-hmm.
It is some of the worst kind of misogynistic language that we have generally seen in, not when it's not on the page, we've seen it in the news.
I took it from two sources. I mean, I don't mean that I literally copied it down from two sources.
I
created it, but it was inspired. One was accounts that Ted Bundy himself theft, which I think were among the things that gave me nightmares. And he was articulate on the subject of how he felt about women and, to a degree, articulate about what he'd done.
Mm-hmm.
And reading those accounts greatly informed the perspective of the killer in the books. The other source for this mindset, and it's very depressing to say it, but literally with a few clicks of a computer mouse, you can find forums where men mm-hmm. do discuss women in exactly these terms. To be clear, we are talking about a psychopath,
mm-hmm.
but psychopathy latches on to certain things and will target certain objects. I mean, objects in the linguistic sense, not in the sense that I would review a woman ever as an object, mm-hmm. but you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying.
Yes, of course.
I clearly do not feel that way about my own gender, so I mm-hmm. needed to do some proper research to understand, as much as I am capable of understanding, the language that somebody like that would use.
You have been sort of refreshingly protective about marginalized groups. You've called out, you know, the misogynistic trolls on Twitter. Your previous work is about protecting the disenfranchised, and this is a real theme that goes through, I think, all of your work. Was this series of crimes in this book, was this sort of another way to sort of sort out this kind of evil, this kind of misogyny in the world and confront it yourself?
Well, I would never have, genuinely, mm-hmm. I would never have such a grand aim for a detective book. I mean, not that I, believe you me, I am happy to think that any book could change any mind. I would love to think that. However, I'm realistic. The kind of person who would think in these terms is beyond the reach of anyone else. There are people who might use certain kinds of language or have certain kinds of beliefs who are not beyond redemption.
There's also a minor, there's Matthew Cunliffe, who, it's this minor brand of misogyny, but he is undermining.
Yeah, I
he's
totally agree.
Belittling.
That's something different. Yeah. For those who can't remember, I'm sure everyone can remember every single word I've written, but just in case they can't. Matthew is Robin's very long-term boyfriend. I think they've been together 9 years. And Matthew, he's unpleasantly surprised to find that the fiance he thought he had is not the real Robin. Robin mm-hmm. is now growing in ways he does not enjoy. She's become far more independent. She's found work she loves. She's extremely good at it. And he's not enjoying that at all. He is misogynistic in a far more workaday fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not. The number of women I've met read these books who've said to me, I used to date Matthew.
Right.
Really? I've literally lost count. Or I know Matthew. So I'm glad to say there aren't so many of the killer around, but apparently there are a lot of Matthews around.
Ms. Rowling, I know Matthew. I mean, this is actually one of the questions I had for you, is that she is so plucky and wonderful and likable. She's often ahead of Cormoran. And
yep.
Why is this young woman so incredibly dim about this dimwit?
Well, let's be honest.
I know.
Let's be honest. How many fantastic women have you known? And then
met
their partners and thought, how did that happen?
Well, that's a different podcast.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I'll meet you back here next week and we'll do 2 hours on that. You know, they met when they were very young and neither of them has been able to form a very well-rounded view of the other because for lack of experience.
So, but that does get at this other thing, and we've talked a little bit about this, but I do want to ask you sort of directly, because all of the victims in this book are women.
Mm-hmm.
But did you balk at all at showing women in this light? You know, how did you think about the victims in this book?
Did I balk? I'll tell you why I didn't, and mm-hmm. it goes back to the killing. That sounds very brusque, but mm-hmm. I truly don't mean it that way.
No.
I looked at my female characters in this book before I even set pen to paper to mm-hmm. write the first chapter. And I was and am confident that you see that women are not only victims in this book,
mm-hmm.
that you see Strike is involved with a very competent and high-achieving woman who, thankfully, has not suffered any kind of violence of this kind. Robin is a survivor who helps catch the killer.
Mm-hmm.
We have a police detective for who I have plans, so though she makes only a small appearance in this book,
ooh.
Who, again, is clearly not a victim but is instrumental in resolving the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to the victims, I feel profound sympathy. And I will say that the one of the victims who survives, mm-hmm. I could not bear to kill her.
Oh, I was so glad you didn't.
Yeah.
I know.
I couldn't bear to. I wanted her to fight. I really wanted her to fight. But you see them both through the eyes of the killer. You also see them through the eyes of the media.
Uh-huh.
And
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I wanted to look at that. I wanted to look at media depictions of violence against women and how victims are portrayed. There's a point where we know an attempted killing has occurred. Mm-hmm. It was the attempted killing of a prostitute. Mm-hmm. That didn't even make the papers because on that day the royal wedding happened.
Yeah, that's
a... And the point is made that a girl selling herself for sex cannot hope to oust a newly minted duchess from the front page. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe that that is the media we largely live with, and I believe mm-hmm. that's the hierarchy of value placed on different women depending on their roles in life. Mm-hmm. I also think that's a very reprehensible state of affairs. So it was important to me to look at that too. But the fact is that that victim does survive. And I, for myself, really needed that victim to survive. So we always talk about the chip of ice in the writer's heart as per Graham Greene, but my chip was nowhere to be seen on that occasion.
I was grateful. I guess I want to sort of look forward a little bit because there is, the book ends with I'm not going to spoil it, even for
thank
this,
you.
With a major...
Even for our knowledgeable audience.
Exactly, with a major, wonderful cliffhanger.
It does.
When is Robert Galbraith getting back to work?
He is actually back to work already.
Oh, good.
I'm not sure.
Nice fella, is he?
He works hard, that boy. Never stops. I'm not sure when the next book will be out, uh-huh. but I can say that I know what the first chapter of the next book will be, and the first chapter will follow immediately from the last chapter of this book. So you will see.
Oh, that is great.
Exactly what happens
oh,
next,
good.
which I think having done that cliffhanger, I really owe to the audience not
yes.
to just leave them hanging
yes.
for a flashback that might happen in chapter 15. I think you've really just got to keep going then.
Oh God, that is such a relief to
I'm
this
glad,
to
I'm
this
glad
devoted reader
because I just felt that would be outright cruelty and sadism if I didn't tell everyone exactly what happened.
Forget
next.
The dismemberment. Don't do
yeah,
that.
Don't do that. That's proper cruelty, exactly.
Well, this has been such a pleasure.
For me too, it really has.
Thank you so much for talking about the book. This is Robert Galbraith, that is the pseudonym for J.K. Rowling. And thanks again so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for listening to that interview. Barry Hardiman and J.K. Rowling, pretty exciting.
Not bad.
That's pretty cool, pretty cool. So we do hope that you enjoyed that. Again, please subscribe to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's at npr.org/popculturehappyhour. That's where you can subscribe to the show. NPR has lots and lots of great podcasts. And I think, Stephen, you have a little bit to say about one of them before we go.
I absolutely do. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, check out Ask Me Another. Play along with a Seinfeld-themed version of Taboo, games of mysterious phenomena, see what you know about some of the lesser-known characters on Sesame Street. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.